portion of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Martha Potter for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, we'll be reading selections from Our State magazine. Today's reading of Our State magazine is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting this podcast for over 15 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. And since we have five Tuesdays in the month of March, we will get a bonus episode. And in this episode, we'll wrap up the March issue of Our State magazine with a few of the regular columns. And the first one is entitled Sleeping Beauties, and it's in the column of Hidden History, Uncovering Forgotten Artifacts and Delving into Dusty Archives to Explore the little-known Stories of Our State. And so this is, again, Sleeping Beauties. In Candor, the Aberdeen, Carolina, and Western Railway is a reawakening and appreciation for railroads and slow travel with a glittering fleet of restored train cars. As you settle into a sumptuously upholstered chair in the parlor of Romer, a private rail car built in 1918, you might wish to ponder the journey into the past on which you're about to embark. This was a time when business titans like the Rockefellers and the Astors drove the American economy, often aboard their own roving palaces. A roamer, tipping the scales at 100 tons, is like a miniature Biltmore on wheels. Vast expanses of hand-carved quarter-sawn oak, luxurious cherry-wood-lined bedrooms with brocade curtains and bedspreads, lavish fixtures, glittering chandeliers, and bathrooms clad in Italian marble. Even the hinges are ornate, marvels Robert Menzies, owner of the Aberdeen, Carolina, and Western Railway, the acronym ACWR, a short line or regional railroad headquartered in Candor. It's one of the most expensive cars of its time I've ever seen. Over the past several years, Menzies and a team of craftspeople have restored about a dozen classic railway cars to their former glory. Some are sleeper cars, but they're also parlor cars, dome cars, baggage cars, and diner cars in the mix. Romer, though, stands out. Built by American Car and Foundry Company in St. Louis, it was commissioned by oil tycoon Joshua Cosden, who was said to have owned the largest private refinery in the world. He died in 1940, but Romer rolled on for several more years before coming to what seemed to be its final resting place in Illinois. There it sat for more than four decades before Menzies purchased it and gave it a second life, employing 42 workers over 6 months to restore the car. The money you'll spend to fix these, the money you'll spend to upkeep them, it's a labor of love, Menzies says, trying to explain his obsession. And being a little crazy, it often helps to be a little bit crazy. Menzies' love of trains runs deep. By his estimation, he racked up 17,000 miles hopping freight trains in his younger days, including a spring break trip in the 60s from Michigan to California with college buddies. His sales pitch to them? All it costs is a loaf of bread and some sardines. That same passion led to degrees in transportation and logistics, followed by teaching stints at two universities. I've always loved anything that moves, he says. I was born to travel. But by the mid-1980s, he was following in his dad's footsteps as a businessman and entrepreneur in Michigan and California. Then he saw a classified ad for a tiny railroad in North Carolina. It had one locomotive and 34 miles of rapidly deteriorating track between Aberdeen and Starr. The line had begun as a logging operation in the 1800s, and in 1889 was organized as Aberdeen and West End Railroad. After changing hands and names multiple times over the next century, it was known as Aberdeen and Briar Patch Railroad and operating as a short line, providing first mile and last mile service to shippers or receivers by linking up with regional and national carriers. Menzies had exactly zero experience running a railroad, but his lifetime of enthusiasm for transportation made the opportunity irresistible to him. He purchased the short line, and in March of 1987, Aberdeen, Carolina, and Western Railway was incorporated. On one occasion in those early days, Menzies was running the locomotive, taking the first set of seven cars to the new Purdue feed mill nearby. Rehabilitation of the tracks hadn't yet been completed, and five cars derailed on a curve. Three of them flipped. A rational person would have said, "This isn't going to work." But his Scottish perseverance got him through it, says his son Anthony, ACWR's CEO. "It took us 16 years to break even and 20 years to make enough profit that we knew we were going to make it," Menzies said. Today, ACWR is the largest privately owned short-line railway in North Carolina. Around the time it began to show a consistent profit, Menzies turned his attention to vintage rail cars. Along a peaceful stretch of North Carolina Highway 211, the scene inside ACWR's massive workshop is anything but. Four parallel sets of railroad tracks cradle a dozen vintage train cars and locomotives. Some are stripped bare as skeletons. Others are fully restored, and those remaining exist in various stages of reincarnation. In this cavernous space, amid the smell of wood glue and grease and a cacophony of table saws, drills, and sanders, Menzies and his team lovingly coax more than 130 years of railroad history back to life. In addition to private cars like Romer, they've restored several cars that once served everyday travelers. When you look at cars the public could ride in, the Mission Saint-Inez might be the most important, said Pullman scholar David Duncan of this ladies' lounge and sleeper car built by the Pullman Company in Chicago in 1926. No one has gone to that much effort to restore a car. The ACWR team also spent an extraordinary amount of time and effort on the Pinehurst, originally known as the Defender, a Pullman car from 1912 that required the removal of 32 coats of paint to reveal the exquisite mahogany of its interior. And the San Marino, a private rail car of railroad magnate and philanthropist Henry Edwards Huntington. To actually step up onto one of these cars and get the feel of the space and atmosphere and what it would have been like to watch the country unfold behind you is just an incredible experience, Duncan says. From sheer stick-to-itiveness, the Menzies Vista, a stunning mid-1950s American car and foundry dome car, might take the cake. "That dome car was actually 10 years of our life," says Dale Parks, ACWR's vice president of mechanical. "Raccoons were living in it. It took more than 2 years to get the car in shape just to move it from its location in Wisconsin to ACWR's 90,000-square-foot workshop. With no historic or archival information to go on, the car presented a blank slate." Menzies tapped into his creative side to transform it into a modern Art Deco masterpiece. The wide variety of projects represent not only the breadth of Menzies' interest in railroads, but also his belief in the importance of saving as many kinds of iconic cars and preserving as much railroad history as he can. "Most people wouldn't do this," Parks says. "If Rob didn't have the heart and the passion for railroad transportation, this stuff would go to the scrapyard." Far from being static museum pieces, ACWR's restored cars are both beautiful and functional. Despite their age, three of the cars are certified to run on Amtrak rails and can be joined to a regularly scheduled train. ACWR also deploys several cars pulled by their own locomotives for seasonal themed excursions. In 2024, ACWR partnered with the Rail Division of North Carolina Department of Transportation to bring patrons from Raleigh to the U.S. Open in Pinehurst. The golf lovers traveled on passenger cars from the North Carolina rail car fleet with the Summit View Dome car, another ACWR restoration, hitched to the end. They disembarked in front of the country club where the Pinehurst Railroad Station once stood, arriving like golf legends Bobby Jones, Gene Sarazen, Glenna Collett-Vayer might have back in the day. The service was a hit, selling out trains in each direction all 4 days and handling more than 2,500 passengers. Some of ACWR's restored cars are on display right next to Pinehurst Resort, including Engine Room 87, a beer bar fashioned from a retired locomotive. The other cars, including Roamer, are kept in ACWR's Candor shop, where monthly public tours of these marvels are led by volunteers who are just as passionate about rail history as Menzies. "I just love seeing people be able to enjoy the beauty of what used to be," he says. And maybe again. Menzies' hope is that by reintroducing people to a more relaxed and thoughtful way of getting from point A to point B, they'll begin to appreciate what he calls slow travel, a reminder that, as Menzies himself knows well, the journey can be as gratifying as the destination. The Aberdeen, Carolina, and Western Railway is located at 967 North Carolina Highway 211 East in Candor, North Carolina. And their phone number is 910-974-4219. That's 910-974-4219. And their website is acwr.com. Our next article is from the new column entitled "At Home Here." In every corner of North Carolina, there's someone whose story captures the heart of where they live. This article is entitled "Where Her Work Still Speaks." From a reclaimed community center to a long-forgotten cemetery, the Cumberland County land Amy Jenkins tended keeps telling her story. I find Amy McCray Jenkins underneath an open-air tin-roofed shed near tables full of food. She's sitting, her cane within reach. She knows she'll need it when she gets up to fill her plate with what she calls good old soul food. Fried fish, cabbage, collard greens, and cornbread. But right now she can't. She's got too many people walking up introducing themselves, reminding her of when and where they saw her last. "Hello there," says a man, leaning down to meet Amy eye to eye. "You remember me?" "I remember a little boy," says Amy, smiling. "I don't remember a grown man." At 84, Amy remembers all who come. And on the last Saturday in September, they come to a gathering off Chapel Hill Road in Spring Lake because of her. Virginia, Ohio, Alabama, Michigan, and various pockets in North Carolina. They come from near and far for the annual celebration of the Sandhills Family Heritage Association, a nonprofit Amy started here a quarter century ago to empower those who have long felt powerless and know their history matters. Amy needed help to make that happen. Everyone she approached said yes. They now run a farmer's market, hold cooking demonstrations, and promote healthy living through diet and exercise. They offer historical tours of Cumberland and Harnett counties, hold church services in a replica of a brush arbor to show how the enslaved worshipped away from the suspicious eyes of white people. They schedule workshops on such topics as writing, wills, and researching genealogy, and distribute food to needy families and older homebound residents. They've cleared out underbrush from a patch of woods behind a parking lot and have begun sprucing up an old cemetery, the final resting place for dozens of enslaved and formerly enslaved people of color buried there more than 100 years ago. Now to the one-story cement block structure painted white about two dozen steps from where Amy sits. In 2001, due to changes in building codes and needed repairs, the structure, known as the Spring Lake Civic Center, was closed and was being considered for demolition. With the help of nearly $500,000 in grants, Amy's nonprofit saved it. They need another $140,000 to finish the outside excavation work and reopen a renovated community center, a safe space for black people during an unsafe time decades ago. "All our civil rights meetings happened right there," Amy tells me, pointing at the building with her cane. "It was the hub of everything. We had a place to come." All morning I hear Amy's hiccup of a laugh as she tells stories and encourages any young person she doesn't know to join the group. "This is not an old folks thing," she tells them, emphasizing every word. "This is a young people thing, too. We are interested in your future." When I get ready to leave, Amy tells me she'll see me in a few weeks. She wants me to meet a few board members and hear more about the consequential rebirth of the land they own. That all happens, but not with Amy. Larry Dobbins was a high school freshman when he first walked into the community center for a sock hop. He couldn't dance, but it didn't matter. He was surrounded by his peers in a big room with many windows and a concrete floor, a pot-bellied stove in the corner, and wood paneling in the back near the kitchen and bathrooms. The best thing? Loads of folk from surrounding communities came together. Larry's second cousin, a bricklayer, helped build it in 1945. He was one of seven tradesmen who volunteered their talents to build a 2,600-square-foot communal hub from cinder blocks and donated materials. It became a home for everything from cotillions to reunions to voter registration drives. Those activities transformed the Spring Lake Civic Center into a symbol of strength and perseverance on less than 2 acres of land once owned by a turpentine plantation. The land was later bought and gifted to Amy's organization in 2005 by descendants of enslaved people who had worked on the plantation. From what Larry remembers, there were no admission fees for any events, and the hamburgers and hot dogs were free. That was where we discovered the need and power to vote, recalls Larry, age 79, a former mayor of Spring Lake who spent 40 years as an educator. We heard about the social issues of life in a caring place. It was a safe place for me. I follow Myron Jones and Janet Brower through a parking lot toward a 230-foot length of yellow chain. Janet is Sandhill's board chair. Myron is the board member who headed up the cemetery cleanup. The first thing we see are the tombstones. When we walk into the wood, Myron points out what's nearly invisible, small flags, faded pink, stuck under and around bushes that mark where someone was laid to rest long ago. Some of these folks still have family members here, and they need a great place to rest, said Myron, a U.S. Air Force veteran and retired sales director for the Fayetteville Area Convention and Visitors Bureau. We expect that for ourselves, right? Myron recruited Eddie Nichols, Jr. for the cemetery project. They're longtime friends and relatives known to each other by their nicknames. Eddie Nick wants to help Cutsey. He also wanted to honor his ancestors. A few are buried in what's known today as Deerfield Cemetery. I want everyone to know these nameless people, says Eddie, an Air Force veteran and a retired supervisor for the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs. Their presence, their life of pain and heartache and doing without, helped everyone living now have a better life. As I walk with Janet and Myron on a carpet of pine straw, I realize their work will continue for years, judging from the constellation of faded pink flags. They'll have to cut down trees, raise more money, do more research, and employ technology to identify what could be as many as 300 graves. We need to do everything we can to make this a sacred resting place, says Janet, a retired educator who taught for 42 years. Amy was the first black student to attend High Point College. She later moved to Durham and became a businesswoman, a computer programmer, and a community college instructor. In the late 1970s, her ailing mom asked her to go back to where they once lived to bring back anything she could find. On her family's property, now owned by Fort Bragg, Amy discovered a chimney of stacked stone, a cross hatch of rotted lumber, and a mason jar, which she brought back to her mom. She also remembers her pain, her dad dying of lupus, racist hate groups threatening her mom, and burning crosses on their land. Her mom fearing for her family and piling them all into a neighbor's pickup truck to escape. They moved 10 miles away to Spring Lake. They were safe, but they lost the land that Amy's great-grandfather, Willis McRae Sr., a freedman, bought right after the Civil War. That all happened when Amy, the oldest of seven, was just 13. From that pain came what Amy later called a miracle. She recalled the joy of playing with her siblings, living on a farm and following the cycle of the seasons on property that felt like family. That memory about connection and kin convinced Amy to leave Durham and move back to Spring Lake right after her visit. At age 60, she started the Sandhills Family Heritage Association. She wanted to empower others and help herself heal. On a Friday last fall, 6 days before I plan to see her again, Amy goes to the hospital because her legs are hurting so bad she can barely walk. We all think Amy will bounce back. She doesn't. She never leaves the hospital. 2 weeks later, she dies with her daughter, Cassandra Bush, and her grandson, Brylan, beside her. On the first Sunday in November, I gather with many inside Bethel AME Zion Church, Amy's spiritual home in Spring Lake, to remember the grandmother blessed with a hiccup of laugh. I hear written tributes from Governor Josh Stein and local officials, and heartfelt testimonials from more than a dozen people. Up front near the pulpit, I see her white casket framed by a rainbow of flowers and a scattering of cards. One reads, "To a real soldier in the struggle." As Amy's homegoing celebration winds down, a soprano in a white choir robe sits at an upright piano and begins to sing, "When I'm resting in my grave, there's nothing more to be said. May the work I've done, let it speak for me. For Amy, it will, forever." Our next article is from the column North Carolina Naturally, exploring the landscapes and living things in our great outdoors. North Carolinians know we're approaching the coast because the trees start growing beards. Unlike humans and billy goats, these beards don't sprout from their hosts at all. These beards are Spanish moss, waterfalls of gray-green life spilling from twigs and branches. They make our world feel more mysterious, enchanted, as if conjured by some mystical wizard. People look at Spanish moss growing out of trees and think it must be a parasite, but it's not a parasite at all, says North Carolina naturalist Bill Reynolds. Spanish moss requires trees or man-made objects like trees for physical support. It needs trees because it has to grow upside down. It has to hang. Hang like beards. Hang like a woman's hair. Like tattered curtains in the windows of forgotten homes. Spanish moss needs the humid air to thrive. It extends a ghostly welcome to those not used to hearing how it hushes the wind moving through boughs. Spanish moss even extends a warm embrace of home to those more accustomed to those long gray fingers. Spanish moss is one of North Carolina's and the Southeast's most misunderstood plants, Reynolds says. For one, it's not a true moss. It's a flowering plant closely related to pineapple. Unlike pineapple plants, which hold fast to the soil with roots, Spanish moss does not dig into trees at all. It takes nothing from the tree but the kindly elbow of a branch to make its home. It's an epiphyte, an air plant, like many orchids. Reynolds says it uptakes carbon dioxide, oxygen, and water from the air, and whenever it rains, it'll gather nutrients from old leaves and other leftovers washed over it. In North Carolina, Spanish moss grabs a pine tree every now and then, but it's more often found on the spreading, textured branches of live oaks, water oaks, and cypresses that thrive in our most humid places. There, it blooms yellow and green, sometimes a little purple, throughout the summer, producing seeds scattered by the winds with hopes of landing on other trees. Seedlings have soft little hooks that hold onto the tree's surface, Reynolds says. Over time, the adult plant can completely detach from the tree because it gets woven through the branches like a spider web. Then it becomes the Spanish moss we know and that animals know, too. Spiders hide in human tangles, and birds like Baltimore orioles weave pouch-like nests from it. Northern perulas, all grays and yellows, live right in the moss, hanging straight from the tree, while Carolina wrens and tufted titmice line their nests with the gray tendrils, down comforters for their babies. Flying squirrels and eastern gray squirrels, too, sleep in the softness of the moss, just as our tree frogs emerge from its mats and twines to sing to the stars. Anoles creep inside to go to bed. Nature has grown used to Spanish moss in this way, to the old lady tresses and the old man beards. We can even help it grow. Around here, Spanish moss does reproduce by flowers, but it thrives more by fragmentation than by seed, Reynolds says. It grows, separates, and part of it blows to a new location or is carried in toes or talons or placed there by gentle hands. That's why if you cut the trees down with Spanish moss growing on them, Spanish moss won't come back. It needs a source and a community of trees around so it can last. Spanish moss doesn't grow as far west as it used to because the forests don't grow as densely as they once grew. Also, the air it uptakes is not as pure as it used to be. We still have a home for it here, though, room for it to make mysteries and fairy tales, homes and hideaways, to wave us warm and welcome us on our way back home. We'll round up this episode with a story from the column A Taste of Our State, Savoring North Carolina Through the Flavors of Home. This was entitled Spring Greening. In a season that calls for tidying, our columnist welcomes a freshly picked mess into her kitchen. Many North Carolinians understand that a vague reference to a mess of greens actually says quite a lot. A mess of something is an imprecise measurement that good Southern home cooks recognize, right up there with pinch, dash, dab, and some, and enough. It's not a weight or a dimension, but an assessment in the eye of the beholder. Make that the holder. Most messes are hand-picked or plucked from piles at the farmer's market. I gather up a mess of large leafy greens in the crook of my arm, cradling them like a beauty queen's prize bouquet. My grandmother gathered her mess du jour out of the garden in her outstretched apron or an enameled dishpan balanced on her hip. My working definition is that a mess is the amount necessary to meet the task at hand and satisfy the mouths that need feeding. A mess cannot be paltry, especially when it's a mess of greens. Cooking reduces a mountain of greens to a mere molehill. Every time I trundle home on armload, I chuckle at the memory of a former cooking class student telling me when she first sent her new non-Southern spouse to the store to buy enough collards for a big meal, he bought only 2 leaves per person based on the enormity of the raw leaf size. The term greens is deceptively vague as mess. No one type of green is ubiquitous across the state. Depending on where someone lives, their mess might be collards, mustard, turnip, kale, or even foraged dandelion and creekside greasies. In eastern North Carolina, down around Aden, it's likely to be locally beloved cabbage collards, an heirloom variety that grows in loose heads, lighter in color and flavor than others. I was raised mostly on mustard greens my grandparents picked for their garden in Watauga County. Early on, I developed a love for their intriguing peppery bitterness that, after judicious cooking, softened like crushed velvet and kind words on my tongue. My family splashed our greens with vinegar out of a sparkling cut glass cruet that was sure to be on our table as salt and pepper. Even when seasoned thoughtfully by the cook, eaters appreciated condiments on the table so they can doctor their portion to their liking. Whenever I eat greens out, I scan the room for bottles of pepper vinegar and hot sauce to corroborate the validity of the establishment's offer. I didn't cut my collard teeth until I was in college, likely first trying them at Mama Dip's kitchen in Chapel Hill. I didn't figure out how to select and cook them, criteria I now apply to other types of hearty seasonal greens, until many years after that first bite. We can enjoy fresh greens all year in North Carolina, including through the winter when some varieties peak. I crave the leathery leaves picked after a heavy frost when beads of icy cold dew collect on the surface and shine like diamonds. People say the first frost sweetens them. It's true. When it's cold, the plants convert some of their starches to sugars, making them more digestible. No matter the way you cook them, the greens are always a delicious mess to be in. We've run out of time for today's episode of Our State Magazine. I hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll join us next time. I'm Martha Potter, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Our State Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please give us a call at 919-832-5138. Again, that's 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.